I don't know. My notes say, if I can read my notes, I can't read my notes. The background's, I don't even know what this says. I can't read my notes. I do see here, vocal, oof, topic, oof, not my bag.
Excuse me just one second before we move on. Did you say not my bag?
Not my, that's what my notes say, not my bag.
Were you watching Austin Powers?
It's not my bag, baby. Hello, I'm Jason Dantzis.
And I'm David Hudson.
And I'm Ian Rice.
And welcome to Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews, a podcast where we review a rock record of our choice. Today, we'll be reviewing Motley Crue's 1994 self-titled album. So, Ian, where do you come in with Motley Crue in this record?
When I was a kid, I loved Motley Crue. And I kind of was growing up around the time Dr. Feelgood was a big deal, and so, you know, I followed that, and then they did the Decade of Decadence compilation that had Primal Scream on it, which is one of my favorite Motley Crue tracks. And then everything, the wheels kind of fell off Motley Crue, and grunge came through, and people saw this record, which introduces John Corabi as the lead singer because Vince Neil took a hike. They saw this as like Motley Crue's version of grunge, you know, their take on grunge. And I don't see it that way. It's a very heavy record. I actually got into it much later because it was kind of ignored at the time. It didn't do very well, and so I came to love this record later. But I think it's probably the strongest record they have, top to bottom.
I am not a Motley Crue fan. Never really have been. I liked a few songs on Dr. Feelgood. Now I agree with Ian. The stuff on Decade of Decadence was really good. Primal Scream is without a doubt my favorite Motley Crue song. And we'll talk a little bit about what Mr. Corabi did with that when they played it live later. But just wasn't a big Motley Crue fan. By this time, I wasn't listening to this kind of hair metal anymore. I was completely obsessed with Alice in Chains, especially Dirt. And this was right around the time Jar of Flies came out. But I used to read all those Metal Edge magazines and stuff, and they talked about this album for a solid year and a half in the music magazines. And it was supposed to be called Till Death Do Us Part. And I had never heard The Scream, which was Corabi's band. I just know he had a cool look, didn't know what he was going to sound like. And I actually didn't hear the single before the record came out. So my friend Michael Ray and I drove, and we got it without either of us hearing it, because just wanted to hear what it sounded like. And we put it in the car, and both of us just looked at each other and were like, oh my gosh, this is great. And so I've always liked this album. I can't not tell you how many people I know that cannot stand Motley Crue and love this album. It's pretty universal. But anyway, that's my history with it.
All right. For me, I admittedly do not listen to a lot of, I guess what you would call like 80s originated hair metal bands or heavy rock bands. When the late 80s came and I got into the age where I started listening to music about 10 years old or so, 1988, the thing that I gravitated to was, you know, rap and hip hop. So I was listening to NWA and Public Enemy and Ice-T and all that stuff. And that was what I really fell in love with. And it wasn't until the early 90s that I started listening to rock records, particularly grunge stuff. Got into bands like the Smashing Pumpkins and Alice in Chains and Stone Temple Pilots and et cetera, through working at this little restaurant. And my manager there, his name is Kelly, and he did not like that I listened to rap music and was convinced to transition me into a rock fan. And so every day while I was back doing dishes, as a young teenager would do, he was bringing in these new records that would be the thing that would convince me to transition. So I skipped over the whole 80s band stuff and went from basically rap and hip hop right into grunge and then into shoegaze and 90s alt rock and all that sort of stuff. So I never Motley Crue and Poison and all of these bands like this just passed me right by. Never really got into it at all. Everything I listen to now is retrospective. I'm catching up on the fly as we go. And the problem I have a lot of times is I liked so much, particularly the heaviness of grunge and the shoegaze stuff, that it's very hard for me to go backward and listen to it. As far as this particular record goes, the only reason why it was on my radar at all is when we, the three of us, started talking about the year 1994 and how much great music came out in 1994 and started kicking around, like, if we were going to make a list of 10 songs from 1994 that would kind of define what music sounded like back then, what would those songs be? And somebody put a song from this record on. Hooligan's Holiday, maybe? Was that Ian, maybe, that put that on there?
I think so.
Yeah, I don't remember which one, but my first reaction is, why does this song not belong in the company of all these other tracks when you think about everything else that came out in 94, to which then you guys challenged me to listen to this record. And because we now have a platform where we can review said records, we decided to do this one. And so it took me quite a while to get up the nerve to actually listen to it. And so for the past week, I've listened to it many times, but that was the first time I listened to it front to back. And I will give you my opinion thusly.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So now I'm going to give you some basic facts about this album. And if you don't think I'm looking at Wikipedia as we speak, then you are naive, because that's what I'm doing. So Motley Crue is the sixth album from American rock band Motley Crue. It was released on March 15th, 1994. It was recorded at A&M Studios in Hollywood, California, as well as Little Mountain Studios in Vancouver, Canada, between 1992 and 1993. It was produced by Bob Rock. It reached number 7 on the U.S. Billboard chart and is certified gold. And we'll introduce everyone to the players in the band. First up, we have, as Ian mentioned, John Corabi on lead vocals, acoustic guitar, rhythm guitar, and six-string bass. We have Mick Mars on lead guitar, six-string bass, sitar, mandolin, and backing vocals. Nikki Sixx on bass, piano, and backing vocals. And Tommy Lee on drums, piano, and backing vocals. There is a healthy list of guest musicians that we will mention as we see fit. And basically, all songs are written by Nikki Sixx and John Corabi, except for one specific example, which we will get to. All right. So now that we kind of know what this record is all about, let's get to the track by track. And we put the, in this era, this was a CD, right, that we probably had, 1994. We're pretty heavy into CDs. So we slide that thing in and we push play, and the first song is Power to the Music.
It's a great way to open the record. It's a very, very heavy riff, and it kind of sets the tone for the vibe of the entire album. This is much heavier than anything Motley Crue had done prior. I think the addition of a second guitar player, because John Corabi obviously played rhythm guitar, added a new element to the sound. And the way Bob Rock records drums is unbelievable. I think this is probably, this record is his finest example of how he records a drum sound. It's actually at Little Mountain Studios. There's a room he has there, the drum room. And for the longest time, I mean, if you listen to Metallica's Black album, David Lee Roth's A Little Ain't Enough, The Cult's Sonic Temple, all those albums, they have this drum sound to it. And it's just, it pairs itself well with the heavy vibe. You know, lyrically, I never like songs that are these kind of like gung-ho, like power to the music. But, you know, it's musically, I love this. I love this track. And I think it really kicks off the album nicely.
Well, the album opens with a sick, thick Mick Mars down-tuned riff. Then one of the MVPs of the album shows up. Tommy Lee plays the best drum fill intro of his career up until that point. The song has a mid-tempo groove with alternating guitars dropping in and out with a very prominent Tommy Lee hi-hat. We get the first dose of Corabi's bourbon and cigarette-tormented voice. The song is about the power of music in the lives of youth. It's a way out of the pain and realities of their life. The music is a great outlet for aggression and depression. It's also referencing the LA riots, which had happened a year or two before that. I think it's done in a way that isn't cheesy or cliche. I agree with Ian. I hate it when it's like, oh, rock music and, you know, we got to live for rock. I don't take it as that. Also, the addition of another guitar player adds another layer to the sound that allows Mick Mars to have thicker solos. The grinding riffs coming out of the solo are just so good. The song does go on for a little bit too long at the end when it just keeps saying power to the music in the streets. I think they could have knocked a minute or 90 seconds off of it. But I agree with Ian. This is a great way to introduce John Corabi. It's a great way to introduce This Is a Different Band, and I'm here for it.
All right. As a person that's not listened to this band sort of in general, I'm familiar with some of the big hits, of course, Dr. Feelgood and Girls, Girls, Girls. So I kind of had that as my reference point as I was going into this. As I hit play, obviously, it's, you guys have both mentioned it, that power pop riff that comes out right at the beginning. It's notable. It sounds of the time. This is what was being played at that time. To me, it's a couple of years too late. This gives me a feeling of Core or even the first Alice in Chains record, Facelift. So those came out, you know, a few years earlier. So I feel like they're a little behind if they're trying to fit in the times with this sound, but it sounds good. Right away, the biggest thing that turns me off is the vocal. David, you referenced it as the bourbon and cigarette vocal. I didn't have a way to contextualize it other than I didn't connect with it at all. It's kind of speechy. It's not rap, but it's got a little bit of sort of beatboxiness to it. It's not very melodic. And that just, you know, as a fan of, you know, bands that have these amazing singers and really being a fan of really melodic singing or bluesy singing, this is difficult for me to wrap my head around, especially when it's layered over such a great riff. The chorus with the sort of, I don't know if it's harmonizing exactly, but it's definitely a gang vocal. It's a big vocal of the power to the music in the streets. It's the lead vocal where he's kind of shouting over it that's what rubs me the wrong way, and I couldn't get over it. At one point, he uses a vocoder or a megaphone effect of some sort that comes into it, and it just continues to push me off a little bit. I do like the chugging riffs that are under the solos. I agree, David, the solo riffs in here are good. I particularly noted like the third solo riff. This sounds a lot to me like if a band like Days of the New were to be electric but have a better vocalist. I'm trying to contextualize like where this sits in the pantheon of 1994. Definitely too long. There's not enough dynamics here to justify how long the song is. And honestly, that's going to be a theme throughout this. Every time I press play on a song and I see that it's 5 minutes and something long, I'm just right away like, oh, man, this, here we go. So we're going to work through that as we go. The fade into like the little baby chime things, like how they segged from one song to another was a little uniquely weird, how it kind of faded out and then had some sort of little sound effect and then the next song would start. So right away, as we get to song one, I'm a little apprehensive of how this is going to go, but I see that there's some musical meat to this, so I'm going to keep going. And where we keep going is to track two, which is called Uncle Jack.
All right, so Karabi is one of my favorite vocalists, probably a top 10 vocalist for me. I love his voice. This is a true story about his uncle, who was a child molester. And I've read his autobiography last year, and it's a fascinating read. He's the most self-aware, honest rock star I think I've ever read anything about. He gives it to you, everything, warts and all. But anyway, so this was his uncle, who was a child molester. And the song starts with a cool backwards track. Then we get a straightforward groove from Tommy and Mick. Then Six comes in with the bass. All right, so this is a song that Vince Neil could never sing. And he couldn't do it. They couldn't write it with him because his voice, to me, it just sounds like a pig being slaughtered with a chainsaw. It just drives me up the wall. But anyway, the song is an honest portrayal of the feelings Karabi had for his uncle and the sympathy for the victims. It seems as if Karabi's voice is doubled in parts, and the solo by Mars is very subdued until the back end of it. And the power of this song is in the delivery of the lyrics. I do have that this song has kind of an odd, sledgy play out, but I think that's kind of an effect to maybe portray desperation or something like that. But this is one of the more serious tracks in their catalog.
I like this track. I mirror a lot of David's sentiment for it. My problem with this track, aside from it being slightly too long, like Jason, I completely agree with you. Most of these tracks are a bit too lengthy, and I think that's was a problem of the CD era when CDs became a thing, and you could fit so much more information on them. You know, people all of a sudden are putting 16, 17 tracks on there, and everything's going much longer. But the real problem with me for this song is its placement in the track order, because to me it gets in the way of going from track one to track three. That would have been a real solid 1-2 punch for me, like to start the record. But otherwise,
if you put this number three and let it right in to Misunderstood, it'd be awesome.
Yeah, it really would have, just if they had swapped that. It's an odd placement of the track, but overall, I mean, you know, it's kind of a creepy subject matter, and you know, kind of a, again, that kind of subject matter is a little weird early on in the proceedings too. But you know, overall, a good song. I just would like to have seen it elsewhere on the running order.
Yeah, I agree. As somebody who's not familiar with this and giving it a first listen, when the vocal comes in, "Are you ready for suicide? Let me run a razor across your throat." Right away, I'm like, "What exactly am I getting into here?" The layered riff that's playing through there is very cool, and I really think that the pre-chorus, it's a little tinny. It's not as depthful as I would like, but the structure of the song is pretty good, but the lyrical content is pretty shocking, especially if you don't know the backstory, you know? So that was my biggest challenge with it, is that piece. Now, again, I'm going to go back to, I know, David, you said this is one of your favorite vocalists ever. This is another song I just continue to struggle with the vocal. To me, it's not singing. To me, it's like it's talking, and the backing vocals are sort of shouting. I just like something that's a little more melodic and mellow, I guess. And I'm really struggling with the juxtaposition of these really great riffs, which I think you're right, with Karabi on guitar and having the dual guitars is really leading to some very cool, heavy layered interplay riffs that are great ideas. But then it's like, as soon as he starts singing, I'm out. Like I lose my moment in there. And then on top of it, add such serious and sort of, I don't want to say shocking lyrics. This isn't Tool or anything like that, but it's alarming when you're listening to this content. I do like the double time riff that kicks in the solo is pretty good. And I like the little sort of coda breakdown at the end. Again, this reminds me a lot of that early Alice in Chains stuff. This could be the type of musically the thing that would fit on like a Facelift. But it's I'm struggling to keep my attention with these songs because I'm struggling to connect with the vocal and they're just too long for me. I think at one point I'd put out in the text thread, like by the time I got to like song 4 or 5, like I had to take a break for a little while because I felt like I had already listened to an entire record and I'm only halfway through the thing. So I do think they could have cleaned that up and tightened that up a little bit and it would have made a better impact. But alas, we have what we have. So Uncle Jack, then we get through the Alice in Chains like ending coda bit and we arrive at Hooligan's Holiday.
Hooligan's Holiday is a strong contender for my favorite track in this record, and it's largely because of Tommy Lee's drums on it. Tommy Lee is a madman on this song. He is so underrated as a rock drummer because he's Tommy Lee. He's kind of goofy, and you know what I mean? It's, but and he's, you know, in Motley Crue, which a lot of people disregard as a, you know, a hair metal throwaway sometimes. But between the way he plays and the way, again, Bob Rock records him on this, it's such a fantastic foundation for this song. I mean, Mick Mars' guitars on this are fantastic. It's a crime to me that they kind of gloss over this record when they put together their greatest hits albums moving forward, and then this doesn't get a look in, because this to me ranks up there with some of their best material and one of their best singles.
All right, so this was the lead single, and Bob Rock obviously produced this album, and I think one of the things we need to bring up about Bob Rock, Metallica got him to produce the Black Album because they like the way he made Dr. Feelgood sound. And so Bob Rock is almost a fifth member on this album, I think. But anyway, this was the lead single. It was our first taste of post-Neil Crew. I love everything about the song, and the song is about the life of a band, kind of like Crew. And you know, Karabi talks about how fast they bonded when he joined the band, and they just felt like a gang. And it was, you know, one of those things, hey, you pick on one of us, you pick on all of us. But in reality, he's so much different than them. And we'll get to that later on in another song. But like Ian said, Tommy Lee is the showstopper here. I mean, those bass, I don't know what you'd call them, like those double bass drums or whatever the licks that he does. Golly, they're so good. And I kind of push back when some people say this is more of a grunge album. I consider this more of a heavy album, but this one does have some elements of alternative and grunge music at the time. It is a little bit too long, but it's a great song that showcases Karabi and Mick Mars playing guitar. And if you've ever seen John Corabi or listened to a lot of his stuff, 90% of the bands on earth, John Corabi's the lead guitar player. He's an amazing guitarist. And so I don't know who does the leads, honestly, on all of these songs. I'm sure there's some that Corabi takes a lead on, but this tour was a huge disaster in just every aspect. And there's some videos out there of them playing, but their sound is so thick because of him and his playing. But I agree with Ian. I love this song. I think it was the perfect lead single. It showcased everybody in the band. It is a minute too long, and that's a running theme with this. Looking back on it, I think one of the reasons they made these songs a little longer is they were trying to separate themselves from their past as much as humanly possible. You know, most Motley Crue songs, verse, chorus, solo, verse, boom, we're done in 3.5 minutes. Big, you know, anthemic choruses. You don't have that on this album. I just think they were so dead set on separating themselves. Hey, let's make some longer songs and show off this new guitar player that we have and this new sound. But great lead single.
Yeah, this is definitely one of them that jumped out as being one of the better products here. The bright riff that comes in, it's got a hopeful build to it. It starts with great promise. Really like the big riff that is under like the yeah, yeah, yeahs that build into the song. It's sort of, it doesn't really fade in, but like it just starts building this tension. And I'm all on board with this until 53 seconds, the music drops out for the vocal to come in. And then I'm like, this is where Kid Rock got the idea to be Kid Rock from listening to this. The music drops out, and then you have this sort of isolated, again, vocal that I'm not really a big fan of. The verse riff is super cool. That's probably the best part of the song for me. And while the chorus seems a little bit kind of generic with the Hooligans Holiday stuff, it is absolutely earworm. Like, it's the one, this is the one song that I can, only having listened to this for a week or so, even though I listened to it probably 20 times, this is the one thing that sticks in my head that I can think of off the top of my head all the time, is that chorus sort of call of the Hooligans Holiday. But that being said, once we get to about 3:25 for me is where the song starts to fall apart. There's some slide guitar in there that I just don't think works at all. And then we get another sort of long fade out into some, basically some circus music. I don't like the high screechy vocals. The song's almost 6 minutes long. I really felt like David, you said it's a minute too long. I feel like it should have been half. Like, somehow working this song into a 3 minute sort of heavy, more popish type song would have been great. But I start to lose steam with it about second half. But like I said, this is the song. This is the one song that, not being familiar with this record, it pops into my head, and I still catch myself singing that chorus. So well done by those guys for doing that. It works. As you mentioned, this was the first single, which hit number 10 on the mainstream rock charts. And that leads us into second single, which is Misunderstood. Oh, this is the gem of the album. It's one of my favorite Motley Crue songs. Again, it's something that they never could have written or performed with Vince Neil. Now, this song got banned. The video got banned from MTV because it showed a pistol in somebody's mouth. And
about this time, they had kind of a controversial episode of one of the MTV shows where they stormed off the set. And really, reading Karabi's book, he talks about how much that killed them, because MTV at the time was still a big deal. And MTV basically said, we're just not going to play anything of yours anymore. And so it really, he claims it helped to hurt the success of the band. But the song starts with a slow acoustic picking by Karabi, and the song tells the story of several people whose mistakes or life circumstances have left them with a life that is broken. After the first verse, we get more acoustic instrumentation, and that's followed by drumming from Tommy Lee that seems to have an effect on it that makes him sit very far back in the left channel. And then the orchestral strings come in now, which is obviously something Motley Crue's never had. The chorus has some amazing harmonies by Karabi and the rest of the gang. And from what I understand, there was just a lot of people in the studio that chimed in on this with the chorus. One being Glenn Hughes, formerly of White Snake. He's part of the backing vocals. And if you can hear it at the end, there's in between sentences, there's a sound he makes that if you know who Glenn Hughes is, you absolutely know who it is. Karabi's vocals go from the tender side to his raspy tone. I will tell you this, Jason, this is the most extreme of John Karabi's vocals in his career. A lot of his other stuff is the raspiness is toned down. And there's a version of him playing Maggie May on the internet that is just, you'll like his vocals on that. But anyway, like I said, the video is banned by MTV, and I love it. It has many different parts to it. It's almost like three different songs, because when they finally do come in, it speeds up and it gets a lot heavier. That acoustic drumming, like I said, leads into a full band big sound. And the song ends with kind of a sweet sounding acoustic lullaby. But this is my favorite song on the album. And I don't mind that it's long, because it's like different parts. It's like one song goes into another and goes into another. And this may be the best songwriting the band has ever had, because it tells a great story, and the instrumentation and everything is very original.
I think it's very cool to that it starts with the 12 string. That's a 12 string. There's a lot of sounds in this track that you don't often hear with Motley Crue, and that's starting with the 12 string. I also like the opportunity to hear Karabi's more subdued singing voice, because he does, he works in both facets for me. You know, that kind of rock, heavy rock sound kind of vocal, and also, you know, the ballad vocal. And I agree with David. This is a very, very strong display of their songwriting and what they were capable of with John Karabi. And it's a shame that they didn't carry on. I don't, and Jason, I don't know how much of the, you know, the time period that followed this record that you know about, but originally the album that came after it, that they reunited with Vince Neil, Generation Swine, it started as with Karabi as the second.
He even helped them record it.
He helped them record it. He is credited on some of the tracks. But to me, it would have been interesting to see where they went, because quite honestly, I think the record company blew up this version of the band, because it wasn't, you know, the timing was bad. They just signed a huge deal with Elektra, and they get rid of their lead singer and bring in, you know, a virtually unknown guy. And it's a shame, because, you know, it's songwriting like this that really, they could have taken them down a very, very different path after this and come up with some very interesting results.
So we start off with that acoustic riff, and it is melodic. This is the song that I think I referenced of like, oh, now there's a Mr. Big song starting. I think the vocal is good, but the ending notes on the vocals, like when he says the word times, but he says it like times, I don't like that. I just don't like it. When they all kick in, that is very good. The harmonies and all of the violins and all the music ship, like this absolutely I can agree with from a musicality standpoint. This is very well done with all the different parts and how they recorded the different elements. David, you mentioned Tommy Lee with the drums being basically panned far to the left. But they sound almost like he's like literally got like two drums, like he's pounding on a big bass drum, and then he's hitting like a tambourine or something. And it's very stripped down, and it's kind of way kind of back behind you, which is very interesting. And then when the orchestra kicks in, it's almost panned the exact opposite way. Like it feels like they're on the other side of the room, and the violin playing and all of this, which is, by the way, from the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra, because they were recording this up at Little Mountain in Vancouver. And so those guys coming in and adding some depth to it, was definitely good. As I was making my notes at 118, I wrote down, these are some of the best vocals on this record. And then by the time I got to like 210, I was like, oh my goodness, this vocal sucks. Like, I don't like that swing. I love when he melodically harmonizes, and they do a great job of that. The sort of strained speak talk, screamy voice, I just don't like that. That bothers me. And I don't know if that's a draw, like that's a draw to like sort of reference back to. And I mean, he was in a band called The Screams, so that makes sense to me, but I don't know if that's just trying to sort of pay an homage to what Motley Crue used to sound like, or what just 80s bands in general used to sound like. But this came out in 1994, and you're in the company of Amorica and Vitalogy and Jar of Flies and REM Monster and these massive records with amazing vocalists. And to try to put this in that same company, I really struggle vocally. Guitar work, absolutely on the same page. I think he adds a ton. I think they do a lot of fantastic stuff musically. The vocal part, I just don't get it. It's not clicking with me. And then by the time you get to the second half of this, when it kind of tries to go really heavy, the idea of the acoustic ballady piece was the idea that they should have leaned into. When they go full heavy, that's where I start to lose steam on the track. Again, it's almost 7 minutes long. I think if you could have just leaned into that idea, maybe made this a 4 or 5 minute track, I would have been totally on board. The first half of the song is fantastic. So the next track is Love Shine.
I think this track, you know, it's a little quickie, 2.5 minutes. It's one of the shorter tracks on the album. It's a good track. It reminds me a lot of Coverdale Page. Like, it has that sound to it. And I love the Coverdale Page record. That's probably what I like it. Little maybe out of place on this record. As much as I like the song, if we were going to shorten this one up a little bit, this probably would go, because it's to me out of sync with the vibe of the rest of the record. But great little tune. A nice little segue, you know, to go into what would be the second half of the album.
Oh, Ian, we've got to do Coverdale Page now. I love that album. All right. So this is kind of a campfire sing-along song to some extent. I love the harmonies on this. It's a short song. It sonically kind of an oddball on it, but I think they were showcasing a little more of kind of a softer side without like the typical power ballad structure and sound. It's about searching for a long lost love from your youth, and you're hoping that you can, you know, return to those kind of feelings. It's a simple and effective song.
Yeah, acoustic number again. I like the humming that comes in there. It does remind you, David, you said it just right, like a campfire song. It's got a nice groove. You know, I one thing I will relate is we're sitting here on track five, and I haven't done a good job of acknowledging, but the drum sounds and the drum playing is not a problem. Tommy Lee is on fire. He sounds great. And even this, when you're just playing a little acoustic number, his groove is fantastic. And again, I think they sound great when they do these gang vocals sort of harmonizing things. I think it sounds fantastic. The concept to me with Love Shine, I guess it sounds like a kind of a repetitive idea that's maybe sort of a stolen concept, but it works for the tune. I love how it just has a enough acoustically and percussion wise to power it along. And it's 2.5 minutes. It's, like you said, it's a short little thing that comes in, cleanses our palate for the next track, which is Poison Apples.
That I think from a lyrical and kind of a theme standpoint, they could have done with Vince Neil. It starts off with this dampened effect of the band playing a bar or two. Then the full band comes on like a full frontal assault, punch in the face. The lyrics, I think, aren't that great, but I love the delivery that Karabi has with his vocals on this. I have here, they were supposed to kind of be getting away from the hairband cliches, but that, in my opinion, they failed on this one. But my co-host of State of America is going to love this song because they mentioned one of his favorite bands, Mott the Hoople. But this song, it is what it is. If the lyrics were better, this would be one of my more favorite songs on the album, but I cannot take away the lyrics on it. It's just, you know, the lifestyle of a rock and roll band, and, you know, we're going to get in fights, get drunk, and, you know, have as many women as possible, and we're just rotten to the core. So it is what it is.
This one actually is the back and forth I go with between Hooligans Holiday and this one is like my favorite track from the record. I mean, David's right. They do mention Mott the Hoople, which is always a bonus. I think that's kind of cool because I would never connect Motley Crue and Mott the Hoople. But I particularly like the chorus vocal on this. The chorus is very catchy, and the riff throughout the verse and the chorus, I think, is great. I mean, yeah, David's correct. This is the one that's probably most in line with the Vince Neil Motley Crue stuff, and I can see that, but it's just something musically about it. And worth noting, this is the one track on the record that has a co-writing credit from Bob Rock.
Ian, I will interject real quick.
Yes.
So Karabi is not a fan really of heavy metal and the hard stuff. He talks in his book big time about being a child of the 70s. He's a big like Aerosmith guy, Foghat, Zeppelin. He's a big Beatles guy. And so I think Mott the Hoople probably falls into his bang zone. Cause I don't think he's not a fan of like heavy metal, and he's not a fan of music that you would think would go with his voice.
Interesting.
Okay. I got to talk about this song now. So here's what I got. I'm going to just be honest right at the beginning. This song, the vocal, can't handle it. The topic, can't handle it. My record, for listening to this song, which is probably 20 times I went through this record. The longest I made it through this song ever was 132 before I just said, screw it, I'm skipping it. I don't like this song. So when I hit skip, I come to the next song, which is called Hammered.
I like this track. This to me is a spot where Nikki Sixx really shines. His bass sounds fantastic on this tune. And I just the overall vibe of this song is just great. I mean, it's musically everything on this record really attracts me because it's so much darker than what you're used to from them. And that's not even factoring in the lyrical content or the themes or anything like that. Just musically, like it's almost like they said, made a conscious effort to everybody tune down a whole step and, you know, play real guttural, grimy riffs. And, you know, I guess if you want to call that grungy, that's, you know, one way to go with it. But, to a point you made earlier, Jason, the reason why I think this record is fantastic in 1994 is it doesn't really sound like any of those other records to me. And that's exactly what Amorica is like. Not that these two records are, you know, travel in any of the same spheres, but they're both way disjointed for the time period that they're in. And that's kind of the attractive thing to me.
All right. I think this is the best produced song on the album. It has some of the best groove on it, like Ian said, and of the album. I think this overall may be the best playing on the album. The thick riffs that Mick and Krabby, and I always call him Krabby because that's what all he refers to himself. So I have in my notes Krabby here. It's a sludgy and deep groove. This is a really good headphone song if you ever want to like really pick up on the nuances of it. And the song is, it's a lyrical theme that he kind of hits on a lot. He was not a fan of Hollywood and that lifestyle. He's a working class guy from Philadelphia and has worked hard all of his life, not scared of working, and really had to fight and, you know, claw for everything that he wound up getting. And so, my interpretation is about the dangers and entrapment that was alive and well in Hollywood at the time. People are abusing all the normal vices of stardom or the pursuit of stardom. And he's been trying to live this lifestyle and he wants out because of the consequences he sees in those people who get trapped in that pursuit. I do like the numerous short solos that do not follow the typical rock song format. And like I said, Krabby is a very no-nonsense practical guy. And he talks in the book about being floored by how much money the other guys in the band spent with their advance. And when he got his money, he went and bought a pickup truck. And he tells a story about how Tommy and Nikki just made fun of him for that. And they're like, we're rock stars. We drive Ferraris. And he's kind of like, I'm holding on to my money. I got a truck that I paid off. But I think all of that comes into play with his lyrics on this song.
This is one for me. It's a mid-tempo groover. And I dig mid-tempo groovers, so I like it. It doesn't offend me. 28 seconds in, again, you get that dropout. Music stops, the vocal comes in, and I don't like that vocal. I just don't. Reminds me of really bad old Kid Rock. It bothers me how they do that, especially when like you said, the musicality is so good. Like, we just sing over it. But that's not what they decide to do. At 125, they kick into a solo, and I'm like, this is really good, except for then it's 3 seconds long.
Yeah.
they abandon the solo so quickly and go back into the song. It's unfortunate because it was really good for that 3 seconds it started. But overall, this song's okay to me. If this were on the background, I wouldn't change it. I don't know what it's about. I don't know what the lyrics are because I just continue to struggle to really dig into the vocal. But for a mid-tempo groover, this was okay. This is pretty good. Which brings us to the next track, which is Till Death Do Us Part.
All right. So like I said earlier, this was supposed to be the title of the album, and it was mentioned in like Metal Edge and Rip and Rolling Stone for, it seemed like a year. The album's going to be called To Death Do Us Part. Krabby even got it tattooed on his arm. And I don't think he knew until like closer on that it was not going to be the name of the album. All right. Let me put a little something in your ear and go back and listen to it. That intro is very closely related to a slowed down version of the intro to Enter Sandman. And once you hear it, you can't unhear it. Now, this is a great example of Bob Rock's producing style on this song. It's got that very kind of clean tone to it, which he was known to get, as, and like Ian said, with the drum sound. But one of the critiques I have of this album is the length of the songs, and the back half of the album gets a little more mundane with its variety. And I don't mind mid-tempo songs, but I don't like a bunch of them on an album. You go back and listen to it. I forget the name of the album, not the latest Metallica album, but the one before. This kind of has the same kind of beat and feel that a lot of those songs do. And it's my least favorite song on the album. And you know, the lyrics on it are kind of a tried and true theme for him. Let's see here. It's kind of about the lifestyle and the demons he's dealing with. And he feels like he's let others down with his way of life, but he doesn't trust anyone to take care of himself but him. He kind of goes to this sometimes on this album, this kind of motif. But it's my, like I said, it's my least favorite song on the album. And as an homage to our friend Aaron Martell, this is Huddy's Stinky Stinker.
I kind of like this song. I'm a sucker for the more mid tempo slower tunes, and I really like what drum pattern that Tommy Lee's doing on the drums. I mean, I know I keep going back to Tommy Lee, but he really is the star of this record. And David is correct in saying that this is a real nice showcase for Bob Rock's production style. To me, this song though, it has kind of a Whitesnake vibe to it, like some of those like the middle section of Still of the Night. Like it kind of has that kind of vibe to it. And again, that kind of thing, it's weird, like for an album that's supposed to be Motley Crue's grunge album, a lot of those older elements kind of creep back in here and there, and it's kind of fun to pick them out. But I mean based on the entire running order and the length of the tracks on this, I mean, this album could do without this track, which is a shame to say, because this was probably the title track at one time before they changed the title of the record. But I mean, I could drop this and one or two other songs off, and you'd have a really, really tight album.
So this is staying true to form, because this is one of the few songs that I actually really liked. So, of course, I think what Ian said is exactly right. The Tommy Lee groove with the little stop and start with that bass in there, it's very good. It's got a nice little pulse. Again, I do hate the yelling vocal. It's got a nice melodic solo, which I like into. I like when it kicks into high gear. Biggest thing for me continues to be the vocal. David, I hear you and you're saying like just how much you enjoy it. and enjoy Corabi with his vocal and how much Vince Neil, you know, relates to pigs being abused in various forms. But I just struggle with the vocal. But man, this particular groove and how this goes is it's probably one of my favorite things on the record. Again, 6 minutes long, guys. What are we doing? This just doesn't hold your attention long enough to be a 6 minute long song. There's not enough dynamics. There's not a lot of changes. There's not enough things that are interesting in it to justify being that long. And, you know, you're 8 tracks in, and by this point we're pushing already beyond what a full length record would be. And we got 4 songs to go. That's where it starts to wear me out, to be honest with you. So speaking to 4 songs to go, we're going to hit to the next one, which is Welcome to the Unknown.
I like this track. I like the way it starts. It has this kind of like swampy kind of slide playing on it. And that's something that maybe Mick Mars doesn't get enough credit for. He knows his way around a slide very well. That we mentioned earlier, Primal Scream, that's a favorite of David's, also a favorite of mine. That showcases some pretty good slide on there too. I mean, it's not, you know, in the ranks of some of the top slide players, but it's a cool effect that he uses to his advantage quite a bit. I mean, to be perfectly honest, you could do without this song on the record and it wouldn't really be a detriment to the record. You know what I mean? It wouldn't be missing. But that being said, I like the way it comes out of Till Death Do Us Part. Like, it's a good follow-up to that. But being that I said you could drop Till Death Do Us Part, this would probably be safe to go too. But again, not a terrible song. Just as you mentioned, Jason, things are starting to get a little long here.
All right. Probably 5 or 6 years ago, Corabi went on tour playing this album front to back. Part of his band was his son was in it. And when they got to go to do this song, Corabi told him, "We're not going to do it. It's too hard to play. It's too complex." And his son said, "Give us a chance." And so they learned the song and played it. And he was like, "Well, you play it good enough for us to play it live." I seriously doubt Crew ever played this one live. I don't have their set list or anything, but he talks about how complicated and complex it is and how hard of a song it is to play. I like it. And like I said, he's going back to that same thing. He's talking about how corporate America and how it rains down on the little man and controls him. And basically corporate America pushes this narrative on people. And we're all kind of like drinking the Kool-Aid and just kind of walking through life, numbed out and believing everything everybody has said to us. I agree with Ian. It's a good song, but at the same time, if it was left out, it wouldn't be a big deal. I mean, I like it, but like I said, toward the end of this album, the themes and the lyrics do get a little repetitive.
Yeah. So another longer song, over 5 minutes, nice distorted start with the big riff that kicks in. This song in particular, this highlights the best parts of this record and the things that I can't get behind in this record. So things I can't get behind: 54 seconds when the vocal kicks in, that I can't, that it sounds very 80s hair band vocal to me, that I just can't wrap my head around. Similarly to when 327, when that vocal kicks in, it's very shouty, it's not melodic, it's not doing the music any favors in my opinion. But you compare that to like at 405, where the nice gang vocal comes in after the solo. It's very welcome. It sounds fantastic. So it's like they can do it if they choose to. And maybe one of you guys said something earlier about like they're trying to distinguish themselves from some of the bands of the time. But to me, this is where some of the bands we mock in the future probably got their ideas. This, you know, I listen to a song like this and go, what's the difference between this and Nickelback? You know, what's the difference between this and some of the early stuff that Kid Rock was doing? And those are universally hated musicians and groups and bands. And yet this is what they're doing, those rudimentary concepts here. And, but they also have the ability to sound very good, like an Alice in Chains or some of these other bands that were huge at the time. So I guess I give them credit for trying to find their own lane through there, but the things that work, they don't do enough of. And the things that don't work, I think they lean into a little too much. You know, mentioned this is a long song, but for me, the best part of the song starts at 441. That heavy riff with the slide that goes out, that's great. That's one of the highlights of the record for me, is that last, you know, 30 seconds or so of the track. I really enjoyed that. You know, it is Motley Crue, so they got to be themselves. So I got to give them credit for that, but I also don't have to like it, and that's fine. So that takes us to the next track, which is called Smoke the Sky.
This is one of my favorite riffs and openings of any song. That opening riff is so good. And then Tommy Lee just comes in and puts on a clinic. And it's just got this chugging groove to it that's so much fun to listen to. Now, I have a very, very hard time understanding what Karabi says in this song. For a long time, I thought this song was about a World War II fighter pilot shooting people down. I don't know why I did that, but it's about getting high. And it's got the line, Reality THC. But it kind of goes through the history of the world and all these different people that partook of marijuana and his love for it. So, like, the lyrics are a little sophomoric, not in a cheesy way, though. They could have, I mean, mentioned Socrates and JFK and stuff like that, but there could be no lyrics on this song, and I would love it. It's on every workout list I have when I'm on the treadmill, which I hate doing, but I have to do it. This is always on there. It's there when I'm lifting weights. Anytime I need something aggressive and heavy, Smoke the Sky is on it.
This song is, to me, I mean, you know, I picked up, I'm not a history nerd such as yourself, so I didn't gravitate to World War II. I picked up on the drug references right away, but that's because I was problematic as a child. But I as much as I like this song, as much as I think it's a great showcase for Mick Mars is playing on this in particular, I don't know. It's just, it's another one of those, and it's kind of to the point you made earlier, David. The back half of this album becomes a little bit more mundane than the top half. And you know, I could probably let this one go and not miss it all that too much. Even though, like I said, it's not a bad tune. It's just you know, we gotta trim this thing down.
Yeah, I'm gonna be on Team David here. Sorry, Ian. I traditionally side with you. Yeah.
Two nerds. What do you think this was about? The Korean
War?
Well,
I don't know, because I don't listen to the vocal. Let me be clear. I don't know what it's about, because the vocal drives me nuts. But the high tempo heavy riff is fantastic. I can see what David's talking about, giving you some energy. To me, the vocal in this particularly, I've mentioned how I don't like the shouty vocal. I don't like the talk, speak, rappy vocal. Here, this vocal sounds very whiny, very throaty. I still don't like it, but the music of it overrules all of that, because the riff is just so good. And Tommy Lee just bangs the crap out of his drums and sets the tempo for just a great groove. And then it slows down 152. It slows down and you get the solo section, which is, it's one of my favorites on the record. I think it sounds really good. But then you get back into like a 216. Again, the vocal is weird. And like, I mean, legitimately, is he just coughing on here? Like, come on. This is to me where it just like, again, it's, I think the musicians in this band are on fire. And I understand what they were trying to do with bringing in Corabi and doing something different from Vince Neil. And I'm going to be totally honest with you. Like I said, I'm familiar with the singles. I know Dr. Feelgood. I know Girls, 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 etc. So I can't tell you what the problem with Vince Neil is and why there's pigs being tortured in various ways referenced when it comes to him. But I'm struggling to find where this is better than that based on the description. And I think it's too bad, because the music, this is one of the best musically songs I think is on the record, and I really dig it. I just can't get behind the vocal. And it also sounds like, the one critique of the musicianship I'll have on this one is, it does sound like that the solo is a little bit offbeat from the groove. Maybe they do that on purpose to just give a little dissension there, but it seemed a little weird. I don't know if it was an overdub issue, or I don't know what happened there. But so that brings us to track 11, which is Dropping Like Flies.
You had mentioned earlier some of these songs sound like they could be fitting on Alice in Chains' Facelift, and I think this is one of those tunes. Definitely, I like it. It's a nice later entry into the album. Just you know, riff wise it's very cool. Musically it's very cool. Lyrically it's very cool. I mean, there's not a whole lot of depth to it. There's not a whole lot for me to say about it that doesn't kind of mirror some of the things I've said about the other tracks on the album. But this is a good one, and this is a keeper for me.
This is my second least favorite song on the album. I would take this Until Death Do Us Part off. Kind of going back to that same lyrical theme again. The song's too long. The dropping like flies thing gets repeated too much. I don't have anything much else to say. This is a skipper for me.
It's so funny how we are just such different wavelengths with this song. This was my easily favorite song on the record. I love the repetitive figure in the background. I love the strums that come in over the groove. Little pick slide in there that sounds really great. The vocal again is not my favorite, but this is probably the best vocal in my opinion on the record. I like the elongated vowel delivery that's very shoegazy, where you have a groove and then you sort of sing long over the groove. So not a lot of words, but they are sung with a lot of emphasis on the vowels in particular. I'm a sucker for that. I like the harmonizing that happens. I like the effects that come into the whole track. I like when it changes time and it kicks into the heavy riff. The guitar figure that's behind that is very good. Again, vocally right there. Again, very great. I couldn't pick out the lyrics. I couldn't tell you what it was about because I'm just really trying to capture the vibe. And this was the closest thing that brought me to a vibe that I was like, yeah, I can get behind this. It sounds the most cohesive in terms of all the changes that happen. It is a long song, but this was probably the closest to a long song that I could get behind because it does some interesting things. The outro really builds, like you get to 3:48 and it starts building, and then by 4:12 it's got this huge sound, nice solo. Does fade out, which I don't like, but the fade's not too bad. All in all, if I were to pick one song that I would save and put on a playlist somewhere, this was the track for me. It was the closest to something that I could really get behind. So that leads us to the last song on the record, which is called Drift Away.
So we're going to close it out with this soft, introspective song. Now, it does to me contain the most cringeworthy lyric on the album. When you wish upon a star and then there's the gang vocals in the background, no matter where you are, that's bad. Otherwise, this is a song kind of about John Corabi. And I completely forgot to go back and look. It's either in the book or an interview I read. This is a very meaningful song to him. This isn't like a ballad in the sense of what was being played the few years before that. It's very, very personal to him, and he's very proud of this song. Got to find a way to get that lyric out. I mean, I figured there needs to be a hand-raised guy in a room. Just go, hold on here. We got a good song. Let's don't put this lyric in. But it was a great way to close the album out. The album really only had two kind of tender sounding songs, and really Love Shine is just more of like a campfire song than like a tender introspective song. And this one is, I really like it. I think it's a great way to close the album out. They've showed you musically who they are, and then now he's going to show you who he is as a person. And I'm telling you, this autobiography is so good because it lends so much insight into him as a person and how he views the world and his work ethic. And he is probably the most unpretentious person that's ever been in a band this big that you're ever going to read about. I came very, very close to getting him on Digital Kill the Radio Star, kind of one of my big misses. But I really like the tune, and I love how it's the last song on the album.
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement with David. I like the way that this closes on a little more subdued, meaningful moment. It's a nice way to close out the record. And I didn't. It's very interesting to hear that it's such a personal song for him. I mean, you can hear that in the lyrics. They are very candid in a way, but it's interesting. Now, I'm actually going to have to read that book, David. I just bought it for you, and I never got my own. I'm going to have to do that now.
It's fascinating. I've got a group of friends that were fraternity brothers that were kind of big into that kind of music back in the day, like the Poison and everything, which I liked all that up until like 1991. But Caton Brooks, my friend, he messaged me and he said, "Are you reading that Karabi book?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I just finished. It's one of the best rock autobiographies I've ever read." So if people are interested in it, it's great, because the Scream was a great band. They got cut short too quick. And he's got a solo acoustic album that if you don't like the really raspy voice, he sounds really good on it.
You guys ever see that bit that's on Jimmy Fallon where they play songs using toy instruments?
Yes.
That's all I could think of when I listened to this song. Are they playing these on like plastic Fisher Price freaking instruments right now? Yeah. I mean, at this point, I was struggling to finish it out. I mean, it's a nice little acoustic sing along. I can appreciate that. I felt like the orchestral elements were okay, but they sounded just compared to like on Misunderstood, where they really added a lot to the song. Again, I felt like it's a bunch of guys in a corner playing child instruments. The solo is actually pretty good. It's nice and melodic, but at this point, I'm kind of exhausted from this record. So don't remember much else about it besides that, but I'm glad that I made it through at this point. So now that we've done the track by track, we will go around and give our final thoughts and album ratings. For you new listeners, the scale is a 0 to 5, where a 5 is a favorite of ours, all the way down to a 0, which is a poison apple that is never to be mentioned amongst the great 94 records ever again. Ian, what is your final thoughts on Motley Crue?
I think this is the real star of this record is Bob Rock. He really recorded it and captured the sound that the band seemingly was going for. And I think it's one of his strongest productions in his entire body of work. Again, Tommy Lee, very strong on this. There's a lot of really, really strong songs on this. It is way underappreciated and underrated as a record. That being said, we could probably trim this down to about 9 or 10 tunes and have a real tight, cohesive record. But overall, I like it. I give it a 3.5.
It's one of those albums from my youth that just puts me at a particular place in time. I'm 2 months from graduating high school, which, you know, I'm going off to a big university here in a couple of months. I'm about to kind of not have the same relationship with my best friend that I've spent 3 years with. He was kind of my one of my music listening buddies. We were both really, really into Alice in Chains, kind of fed off each other on that. And he was a drummer in a band. And when we put this in, from a drum standpoint, he just couldn't believe it. And so I try not to be a person that's nostalgic for the times. I try to be nostalgic for a purpose. So I'm not like, oh, 93, 94. It's just because I was in high school. And it's because of events that were going on in my life or happened at that time. And so honestly, kind of in a sappy, sentimental way, this was kind of the last record that kind of he and I bonded with, and our lives were about to take different paths. And when I look back on that day of us getting, it's a very fond memory of something that changed very drastically a couple of months later. And so I think that's one of the reasons it holds such a high place in my heart. I agree with Ian. Bob Rock knocked this one out of the park. The musicianship on this is great. I'm not sold that Nikki Sixx is a great musician. You know, there's a lot of evidence that he hasn't played live in a long, long time on those shows. But Karabi to me was such a step up from Neil. His playing was so thick and layered. And I know, Jason, his vocals don't do anything for you, but man, they do it for me. And so I'm going to give this, if it was, all right, if we trim 3 songs off of it, I give it a 4.25, but I'm going to have to knock it down to a 4.
Following the success of their 1989 record, Dr. Feelgood, and the 1991 release of Decade of Decadence, which is their greatest hits record, the band proper of Motley Crue went back into the studio to begin recording their follow-up record. Fortunately, at some point in 1992, they had a falling out with our pig abused lead vocalist Vince Neil and ended up dismissing him from the band. However, as Ian had mentioned earlier in this program, they had just signed a lucrative deal with Elektra Records. So they kept the whole thing quiet while they searched for a new lead singer. Meanwhile, a young man named John Corabi, who was a vocalist of a Los Angeles-based hard rock band, The Scream, read an interview in Spin magazine and found out that Mr. Six was a fan of his previous band, The Scream. So they connected, and long story short, they invited Corabi to come in and replace Vince Neil. And they began working in earnest on this follow-up record that eventually came out in 1994. In 2014, Guitar World released an article in which they ranked their 50 most iconic albums that defined 1994. And if you think that listing 50 iconic records that defined one year, I would challenge you to say that that is not even enough. 1994, in my opinion, is one of the greatest years of music releases ever. And if you don't believe me, pull up the list and start looking at it. This record was ranked number 25. To give you perspective, okay, they're ranked number 25. Let me tell you who they're ranked above. Oasis Definitely Maybe was 26. Stone Temple Pilots Purple was 31. Nirvana Unplugged, 34. Pearl Jam's Vitalogy, 37. REM's Monster, 39. The Rolling Stones' Voodoo Lounge was 41. Super Unknown from Soundgarden, 45. Tom Petty's Wildflowers was ranked 48. And just to make you understand what we're working with, Weezer's Blue Album was number 50. If you want to know what the number one record is, Jar of Flies by Alice in Chains, followed by number two, which was Bad Religion's Stranger Than Fiction, which didn't make any sense. For those out there that recognize us from the State of America podcast, Black Crowes of Morica was ranked number five. But to me, for this album to be ranked above records like that just doesn't make any sense. I love the thick, hard riffs that are in here. I love the harmonizing vocals when they do it. I think there's some really great guitar interplay and some nice solos on here. But I agree with you guys said the songs are just way too long. And unfortunately, I cannot relate to Corabi's vocals. I really struggled to get through it. And when you read a list like that, and those are only the records that were listed lower than this for that year, I just don't see a reason to get into this record when all those other records are available. I don't hate any of these songs. The musicality is fantastic. If it was on somebody's record player or if it was on in the car, I'm not going to necessarily turn it off and skip it, but I would probably be in good faith to tell you that this isn't a record that I would seek out and listen to on purpose anytime moving in the future. So I'm going to give it a 2. And I appreciate being able to say that I at least listened to it.
What a sport.
All right. That'll do us for Ridiculous Rock Records for this recording. I've been Jason Donsis.
I'm David Hudson.
I'm Ian Rice.
See ya.
The Ridiculous Rock Records Review Podcast is hosted by Jason Donsis, David Hudson, Sean Hillman, and Ian Rice. Show produced and directed by Jason Donsis. Logo by David Hall. Theme music from the Steepwater Band. Find them online at steepwater.com. If you have questions, comments, feedback, or ideas for the show, or just want to connect, find us on your favorite social media platform at R4Podcaster or email us at ridiculousrockrecords@gmail.com. The R4 Podcast was created by Aaron Martell. Thank you for dropping the needle with us. Until next time, rock on.
Smoke in the sky.
Smoke the sky, Jason.
Oh my goodness, whatever. At this point, as you can tell, I'm excited to continue. Smoke in the sky.
No.
Smoke the sky.
There's no in.
No.
But take the in out.
I,
th-
There's only two of you.
Get it together. There's like two of us.
I know.
Right.
Jeez. Long day.
I am a very highly sought after personality. I'm not going to be bumped for some Pearl Jam single. All right. What is this smut? I won't be a part of it.
Man, if we could tell the stories we can't tell.
That's because I am a highly sought after personality that has
like on that. Yes,
got on, it. On noted. That. Hold on. On let that. Me write this down, David. Ian, highly sought after personality, will not be bumped nor have edits. Got it. Yes.